So the last presentation will be given by Mary Horowitz. It is entitled Progress in Reduced Intensity Hematopoietic Stem Cell Transplantation in MDS. Mary.
Thank you, Steve. Well, good morning. I want to thank the MDS Foundation and Dr. Nimer for inviting me to be part of this panel. It really is a privilege to be on the same agenda with so many acknowledged experts in this disease. What I'm going to talk to you about today is hematopoietic stem cell transplantation, which to date is the only curative therapy for MDS. Much of the data that I'll present today are data that have been reported to the Center for International Blood and Marrow Transplant Research, or CIBMTR. The CIBMTR is an outcomes registry that collects data on outcome of transplants in virtually all of the 200-plus U.S. transplant centers and more than 100 centers outside of the U.S. According to the data reported to the CIBMTR, there are a little bit over 7,000 allogeneic transplants performed each year in the U.S., and MDS is the third most common indication for allogeneic transplantation. The reason for doing allogeneic transplantation is what I just said. It is a curative therapy. This slide shows survival for transplants done for MDS in the years 2000 to 2009. I think you can appreciate that there is a plateau on this curve. And although these are relatively recent transplants, we do have long-term data on patients who are transplanted 10, 15, and almost 20 years ago with MDS showing duration of remission. Although MDS is the third most common indication for allogeneic transplantation, however, fewer than 10% of MDS patients actually undergo the procedure. And if one looks at the patients who do receive transplantation for MDS, you can see that it looks a little different than from some of the data that you heard earlier today. The median age is 57, whether you're talking about related donors or unrelated donors, with almost two-thirds of the patients being under the age of 60 and fewer than 20% being over the age of 65. This slide shows the age distribution of patients with MDS overall, which are over here. You can see the peak is up here in the eighth decade of life. This shows the distribution of patients who are transplanted. The difference is obvious. If we look at this a little differently and you look at the proportion of patients with MDS who actually do get a transplant by age, you see this, that very young patients with MDS are very likely to get a transplant, but once you get to the age of 75, vanishingly few of those patients get a transplant. Now, this may or may not be appropriate, and that's one of the things I want to talk about today. Well, first of all, does age matter? Well, of course it matters. It matters to all of us. It just so happens that age is a risk factor for mortality, even if you don't have MDS. But I think that people underestimate the average life expectancy of older people. Remember, once you get to 70, you've weeded out the weak, and you have the average 70-year-old in the U.S. has an average life expectancy of another 14 years. And even 75-year-olds have an average life expectancy of about 10 years. This shows that average life expectancy of 50, 55, up to 75-year-olds in the U.S., in the general population, not all of which is normal, maybe that's the wrong term, in the general population versus patients categorized by the revised IPSS score, and these data are taken from the recent Greenberg manuscript. And you can see that there is quite a difference, even for patients who are 75, between what they would have expected without MDS versus what they will expect with particularly MDS with higher risk scores. Unfortunately, there's no guarantee you're going to get all those years back with a transplant. And in fact, this data shows historic data with our standard preparative regimens with transplant-related mortality according to age. And you can see that in patients over 60, this was substantially increased. The landscape has changed, however, with the introduction of successful transplantation using pre-transplant conditioning regimens that are of lesser intensity, thereby reducing the organ toxicity that was previously so often seen in older patients. In that setting, in the current age, is age by itself a risk factor for outcome after transplantation for MDS? There are two very large registry studies, one from the European Registry and one from the CIBMTR that I'd like to present to you. The EBMT study from Lim and colleagues, and Dr. DeVita was the senior author on this paper, included more than 1,000 patients who were transplanted between 1998 and 2006. Median age, very much like what I showed you before, was 56 years, and they divided that group into two cohorts, those between the age of 50 and 60, and those over the age of 60. Now, you can see that most of those patients were under 65, so they were at the low range of the 60 to 70 age group. Most of the transplants were done with HLA-identical siblings, but a fair number with unrelated donors, some of whom were mismatched for HLA. And there was a mix of our standard myeloablative conditioning regimens and reduced intensity regimens. I've summarized the data in one slide. This shows the relative risk of transplant-related mortality, MDS relapse or progression, and overall mortality. The relative risk of 1 is for patients in the age range 50 to 60. None of these differences were statistically significant, although the increased risk of relapse in the older patients approached statistical significance with a p-value of 0.06. If we look at this in probabilities, you can see that transplant-related mortality was very similar, relapse a bit higher in the older patients, and overall survival a bit lower, but that difference was not statistically significant. In this study, they didn't find a big difference according to the intensity of the conditioning regimen, but it's hard to know how many over 65s actually, from the paper, actually received the more intensive regimen. The CIBMTR did a similar study of transplants in the U.S. In this study, we actually looked at both patients with acute myeloid leukemia as well as MDS, although we analyzed them separately. Of the more than 1,000 patients, 535 had MDS. We considered four age groups, 40 to 54, 55 to 59, 60 to 64, and 65 plus. All of these patients received reduced intensity conditioning. The next few slides compare the characteristics of the patients by age group. The younger patients tended to have less advanced disease. The proportion with intermediate to high-risk cytogenetics was similar. About 20% of the patients in all of the age groups had therapy-related MDS. This shows the median age within each cohort. We did have 55 patients in the 65 to 78 range, but they were closer to 65 than 78 by and large. Performance score was similar. And a high proportion of these patients had unrelated donor transplants. This shows the transplant outcomes. None of these differences are statistically significant. Non-engraftment, grade 2 to 4 acute graft versus host disease or chronic GVHDs. They were similar in the three groups. This shows the probability of transplant-related mortality and relapse. I don't have to read these off to you for you to see that the lines are overlapping. And this shows MDS-free survival for this patient, the youngest of whom was 40, for a cohort that was transplanted in 95 to 2005. And again, you don't need to see the p-value. The curves are overlapping, as are the overall survival curves. If we divide this by patients with early versus late stage MDS, again, no significant differences by age group. So our conclusion from that study was that age by itself at least between the ages of 40 and 70 should not be a sole contraindication for considering transplantation with a reduced intensity regimen. So what factors do influence transplant outcomes, if not age? If we look at these two studies, in the EBMT study, both advanced disease age and poor risk cytogenetics were adverse risk factors for overall mortality. No surprises here. In the CIBMTR study, in addition to cytogenetics, which was not significant for overall survival but was significant for MDS-free survival, low performance score, and use of an HLA mismatch donor were poor risk factors. In that cohort, we did not have all of the data necessary to calculate the IPSS score. While Saber from the CIBMTR were presenting multivariate analysis of outcome associated with survival in a more recent cohort of patients for which we did have those data. And in that study, in addition to, again, seeing that performance, low performance score and a mismatched donor were associated with poorer outcomes, higher IPSS score was also associated with poorer outcomes. Of course, now we have a revised IPSS score. We're going to have to go back and do it all over again. That's okay. He's young. He can do that. Is there any better way of trying to predict those patients who are going to do poorly with transplant? So low Karnofsky performance score, not having an HLA-matched donor. We now have available to us the HCT, hematopoietic cell transplantation-specific comorbidity index, introduced by Mohamed Sora from the Fred Hutch in 2005, which actually is an inventory of coexisting dysfunction in a variety of organ systems. And you can see that if you look at this list and you think about the patients with MDS who are by and large in their 70s, the likelihood that they're going to have a problem in one of these categories is relatively high, and I'll show you that in a bit. And this score has been shown to have prognostic value in a variety of situations. This is a 2007 article from Dr. Sora and colleagues that looked at the score not only in the Fred Hutch patients, but in patients transplanted MD Anderson. It's since been looked at in a variety of scenarios, including standard conditioning transplantation, reduced intensity conditioning transplantation, a variety of diseases. And in fact, at this meeting, there are four studies from the CIBMTR validating the prognostic significance, the prognostic utility of the SORA index in predicting transplant-related mortality. And those studies, as well as this study, published by Dr. Sora in 2008 using data from the Fred Hutch, shows that that prognostic utility is in addition to the information we get from looking at age by itself and Karnofsky performance score. This is not an MDS study. This is a study of patients with leukemia. What other things impact transplant outcome? There's a growing body of evidence that iron overload, not so unlikely to occur in MDS patients, is a risk factor for organ toxicity after allogeneic transplantation. It seems like that risk is largely in patients receiving myeloablative conditioning, but it should be kept in mind for those patients for whom a transplant maybe in their future, because one might want to consider early use of chelating therapy in those patients. So what about the conditioning regimen? Should all older patients receive reduced intensity conditioning? Should all patients receive reduced intensity conditioning? The CIBMTR has looked at the impact of conditioning regimen intensity on the outcome of transplants for leukemia and MDS. This was published in Bone Marrow Transplantation earlier this year. It actually is a study that includes patients with both AML and MDS. It's 5,000 patients, but it's the entire age spectrum of these two diseases, although there were 503 patients in this study who were between the age of 60 and 70. When we look at conditioning regimen intensity, we look at our standard regimens, which are considered myeloablative, no marrow recovery expected without infusion of normal progenitor cells, and the doses are here. It's not really important to know that. And then two categories of reduction. Reduced intensity, very, very low intensity regimens that rarely, if ever, produce even cytopenia, but are immunosuppressive enough to allow donor engraftment, and reduced intensity regimens that generally do produce cytopenia, but from which marrow recovery might be expected given enough time. These regimens are designed to not only provide adequate immune suppression, but also to provide a degree of disease control while donor engraftment and presumably graft versus leukemia or MDS effects are taking place. In this overall study, you can see that the results with all of those approaches were fairly similar, although from a statistical significance point of view, the best results were seen with either a myeloablative transplant or a reduced intensity, that moderate intensity group, using a peripheral blood graft rather than a bone marrow graft, and lower survival with very low intensity or reduced intensity transplants with bone marrow grafts, and that was due to an increased risk of relapse in these two groups. However, I think I'm not so sure that the results of that study have a lot of implications in terms of how we treat the vast majority of patients with MDS, because almost all the patients with MDS for whom we might consider transplant, if we're considering everybody who might benefit, are going to be over the age of 60. And when we look at that population more closely, we can see of the 3,721 patients out of the 5,000 who received myeloablative conditioning, only 3% were between 60 and 70 years. So I don't think we can say anything definitive. What we can say is, very few patients over the age of 60 are probably going to be considered for a standard intensity transplant in the current era, not only because there is a bias against using more intensive transplants in older patients, but also because they are much more likely, as shown here, to have comorbidity indices greater than or equal to 3. I mean, they're going to have diabetes, they're going to have obesity, they're going to have hypertension, they're going to have all of the things that happen to many of us as we get older. So by and large, once you get to 60, and particularly when you get to 65, most patients are going to be considered as a candidate for reduced intensity regimens. We are trying to evaluate the impact of regimen intensity in a randomized study that is being done through the Blood and Marrow Transplant Clinical Trials Group. And this study includes patients with both MDS or AML. You can see they have to have fewer than 5% blasts. They are randomized to a reduced intensity or a myeloablative regimen. There are two reduced intensity regimens allowed, and 3 myeloablative regimens allowed. And the primary outcome is 18-month overall survival. This study is open to patients up to the age of 65 and to those who have either an HLA-matched related or unrelated donor. And in the unrelated donor setting, a single locus mismatch is allowed. So that will give us data for the younger patients with MDS. But I still say on the basis of it's designed to test a difference of 15% in 18-month overall survival. The accrual target is 356 patients, 178 per arm. And so far, so good. We are projecting a bit ahead of schedule, but I would encourage anyone who has an eligible patient to enroll them. So who do we transplant and when? The decision is shown graphically here. You have a disease that without transplantation is eventually going to progress or to lead to mortality from complications, and you have a curative therapy that we know is curative in a proportion of patients, but at the price of faster mortality for a proportion of patients. So you have this dilemma. So what do we consider? Well, one of the things to consider is life expectancy in general, and this is the slide I showed you before, but let's put it this way. What's the decrement in life expectancy for a 50-year-old with even a low IPSSR? It's 20 years. On the other hand, the decrement in life expectancy for a 75-year-old with very low IPSSR is only about 3 years. And I think we can all agree that you're not going to get every one of these years back with transplantation. So I think understanding what the patient's life expectancy maximum gain is going to be, given the status of their MDS and given their risk for transplant, is the important consideration. So we have to consider the slope of this curve of the yellow, and particularly the early slope of the transplant curve. Now, when this slope is very steep, as in with high IPSS scores, this risk looks much more acceptable, of course. If this is not so steep, and this is very steep, it's not so great a trade-off. This is just a very abbreviated list of the kinds of things you have to think about. One problem is a lot of the things that affect the risk of mortality in the non-transplant setting also affect the risk of mortality in the transplant setting. And of course, this is very abbreviated. You've heard in the last two talks a whole lot about other pieces of information that we can use at least to predict what the patient's outcome is going to be in the absence of a transplant. I think the main things to consider in terms of calculating the risk of that early mortality after a transplant is the performance score and the HCT comorbidity index. Also important is the quality of the donor that is available. As will be shown in the study presented by Dr. Saber, there's significantly better results when the donor is HLA identical, whether it's a related or an unrelated donor. Back in 2004, Corey Cutler led a CIBMTR study that actually used data from the International MDS Registry and data from the CIBMTR to calculate the life expectancy after transplant and non-transplant therapy, considering transplant at various times in the course of MDS, and using a decision analysis approach. What that study showed, this study only included patients under the age of 60, very small percentage of the overall MDS population. That study showed that for patients with low or intermediate one risk IPSS scores, the best expected survival, even if one adjusts for quality of life, was found if you did transplant at the time of progression or shortly before the time of progression, if only we could tell that. For patients with higher IPSS scores, the best expected survival, this is in years, was with transplant early in the course of MDS. Dr. Korath and Cutler and colleagues have subsequently repeated this approach, looking at patients who are 60 to 70. These data were presented last year at ASH and will soon be published. And the results are not so different. This is looking at initial treatment of MDS for those patients with low or intermediate one IPSS scores, whether one looks at just overall life expectancy, these are in months, not years, or quality adjusted life expectancies. A better approach is seen with an initial non-transplant approach, but those with higher risk IPSS scores, longer life expectancy is seen with earlier transplantation. So this goes along with the graphic, high risk of early progression, the trade-off with transplant looks a lot better. And in fact, there are some situations where the risk, the chance of having a prolonged response to non-transplant therapy is so low that one might even accept a higher early transplant-related mortality, such as in those patients who have already failed hypomethylating therapy or who have therapy-related MDS. There's a very interesting study published from the German MDS study group and the German Transplant Cooperative Group in collaboration with the Fred Hutchinson Cancer Center earlier this year. This used two separate cohorts of patients, 100 of three of which were transplanted in either Germany or at the Fred Hutch, compared them to another cohort of patients who did not receive transplantations from the French registry, and they didn't receive a transplant either because they didn't have a donor or because of adherence to guidelines that precluded offering transplant to patients older than 60 years. So you had two separate cohorts of patients that looked relatively similar. This shows those two groups, one at diagnosis and the other at the time of initiation of therapy, whether it's azacitidine or transplant. Very similar FAB and IPSS distributions at diagnosis. By the time they got to therapy, the transplant patients were a much higher risk group, as you can see here. 42% had already transformed to AML, a higher proportion, and which is a high risk, but somewhat lower proportion of high-risk cytogenetics in the non-transplant group, so not completely comparable. This is a summary of the results. Non-relapse mortality, which means mortality in the absence of progression to AML, was surprisingly similar in both groups. However, relapse or progression was much less frequent in the transplant cohort, and survival was significantly higher, 39% versus 23% in the azacitidine cohort. It should be noted that at 1 year, survival was about 50% in both cohorts. It wasn't until 2 years that you saw the advantage for transplant. The follow-up was shorter in the azacitidine group, so we didn't have 5 year survival, but it was 35% in the transplant group, showing very little decrement between the 2 and 5 year time points. The BMTC, this is an interesting study, but it really didn't follow an entire group of patients from the time of referral for transplant or from diagnosis. We are hoping to launch within the first 6 months of 2013 a prospective trial through the BMTCTN that will compare three-year overall survival probabilities between reduced-intensity allogeneic transplantation and non-transplant therapy. Also looking at leukemia-free survival and comparing quality of life between the treatment arms. This is not a from-diagnosis study. It is a from-time-of-referral to transplant study. It includes patients from the age of 50 to 75. They can have any therapy prior to transplant. They have to have a reasonable performance score. And it will be a donor versus no-donor comparison using an intent-to-treat approach. With no mandate of the regimen except that it has to be reduced intensity. This shows the study schema. At 3 months after referral, they will be assigned to either a donor or no donor group and followed in an intent-to-treat manner after that. One of the problems in doing a study like this is that most patients who come to transplant centers, if they don't have a donor, go back to their referring physicians, and this study accommodates that. We're focusing on survival, so we're not asking a lot from the referring physicians in terms of feedback, and then we're going to be doing direct contact of patients to assess quality of life. One other thing I want to cover in terms of a barrier to doing transplant for older patients in the U.S. Most people over 65 in the U.S. have health insurance through Medicare or CMS, and before 2010, CMS did not explicitly cover BMT for MDS, although it covers BMT for AML. Decisions were made locally, and actually very few local decisions were in favor of transplantation. a variety of organizations, including the American Society for Blood and Marrow Transplantation, the National Marrow Donor Program, ASH, ASCO, and others, submitted a formal request to CMS, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid, to consider covering transplant for MDS. A lot of supporting data was provided, including much of what I just showed to you. They accepted the request, held public comments, and weren't totally convinced, but were convinced enough to offer coverage as long as patients in a category called coverage with evidence development, saying that the current evidence was not sufficient, but that they would cover costs of transplant if patients were enrolled in a study that would provide CMS with data to determine the value of the procedure in the Medicare population. Well, we all know what that might mean because, you know, to actually design and implement a study, a prospective randomized or other, or even unrandomized study, takes a long time. It's only going to be active in a few centers. Additionally, the study had to either compare transplant with non-transplant therapy, had to evaluate how various prognostic factors, including IPSS, age, cytopenias, et cetera, affected outcomes, and evaluate treatment facility characteristics that were associated with outcomes. The CIBMTR leveraged its existing infrastructure, which collects outcome data on all of the allogeneic transplants being done in the U.S., that's federally mandated, to institute an observational protocol that would address questions 2 and 3 and compare outcomes in patients who receive transplants for MDS at the age of 55 to 64 versus 65 plus. We will be evaluating prognostic factors. The data on the first 120 patients are actually being presented at this meeting. It shows similar early mortality in the two age cohorts, about 20%. The impact of removing this financial barrier to transplantation in older patients is shown here. This is the number of transplants in 2010 before we launched the study for where patients could be eligible for CMS coverage. And you can see that the number of transplants increased dramatically, and these are our projected numbers for 2012. So what next for transplantation? Obviously, early mortality of 20% is not a procedure. It's not a procedure-related mortality that is acceptable, and we continue to work on ways to decrease that mortality, which is attributable to graft-versus-host disease, infection, and organ toxicity. But in fact, the single most common cause of death after transplantation for MDS is recurrent disease. There are a variety of strategies that have been piloted, none of which is ready for prime time or spectacularly successful. Things that are in trials now are use of post-transplant hypomethylating agents, prophylactic donor lymphocyte infusions with or without azacitidine, and monitoring for minimal residual disease with preemptive therapy. So in summary, transplantation is a curative therapy for MDS that is, I think, underutilized. Decisions about when and whether to apply this therapy depends on patient and disease factors that either predict the natural history of MDS or the risk for transplant-related morbidity and mortality. And future studies are needed to identify the patients most likely to benefit and to improve post-transplant disease control. Thank you very much.